Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Happy New Year, feminist readers! Renee Powers here. I hope you all had a wonderful holiday season. As much as I love sharing these podcast episodes with you listeners, it was so good to take some time off. Of course, my body recognized that I was taking the time off. I was forcing myself to relax, and so my body decided it was a great time to come down with a nasty cold. So you might still hear that in my voice. I apologize for that, but it's definitely on its way out, so this should be the last time you hear a little bit of congestion. Our January boxes are arriving at their new homes, so that means it's time to start chatting about February. I'm so excited about this coming month. This year, we are choosing a theme each month and reading on that theme. So members are suggesting titles that correspond with the theme of the month, and then we'll all vote on that list of titles that they suggest. The book with the most votes is what ends up in our box. This is how we've always done it. We're just doing it within a theme now. Our February theme is romance, with an emphasis on feminist, queer, non-binary, and or trans love. Our members suggested so many good titles, and we're currently voting on them. Some of the books on the list include classics like Ruby Fruit Jungle by Rita Mae Brown, contemporary sci-fi romance like Frankenstein by Jeanette Winterson, and good old-fashioned sexy romance novels like Wrong to Need You by Alicia Rye. As always, keep up to us through our email list and our Instagram. Our email subscribers are actually the first to know about the book of the month, as well as any sales or promotions. So double check that you're subscribed to that. We keep the email communication fairly limited because nobody likes spam. We will only email you when it's something really, really good, like what the book of the month is, what you can expect in that month's box, and again, maybe some promos or sales. You can find the link to subscribe to our email list in our show notes or at the bottom of our website. And our website, as always, super simple, feministbookclub.com. Today's guest is Jeannie Venasco, who is actually a longtime subscriber to the Feminist Book Club box. A few months ago, we were emailing about her membership, and I realized I recognized her name, and it took a second to place it. Lo and behold, I had actually seen her book recommended on a blog. So I asked her, Hey, this is weird, but are you an author? A week or so later, her book arrived on my doorstep, and a few weeks after that, we met up at one of her book tour stops here in Minneapolis. It's so funny how small this world is. Her book is absolutely incredible. Some trigger warnings for you. We do speak explicitly about rape and sexual violence, and there is a mention of suicide. Jeannie's book, Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl, is a memoir about reconnecting with her friend who raped her. So knowing that, please do what is best for you and your well-being. And now, here is that interview. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I am chatting today with Jeannie Venasco. Jeannie is the author of the memoirs Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl and The Glass Eye. Her writing has appeared in The Believer, The New York Times Modern Love Section, NewYorker.com, The Times Literary Supplement, and elsewhere. Born and raised in Sandusky, Ohio, she now lives in Baltimore and is an assistant professor of English at Towson University. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, thank you.
Sandusky is the home of Cedar Point.
Yes. And I was once on a bus in Bologna, of all places, and someone overheard me talking with someone that I was from Sandusky, and multiple people in the bus were like, Cedar Point, like over in Italy, and we're so excited. So
I actually got lost in Bologna. There's another connection because I missed the bus in Bologna. So now, okay, this is getting real weird. Okay, Jeannie. We went off on a tangent. What is your definition of feminism?
Sure. I think it's political, economic, social equality for everyone, like regardless of gender identity.
Seems so simple. It never is.
Yes, I know. It's interesting why I've asked my students, who identifies as a feminist, and I notice a lot of them, you know, they agree with feminism, but they think that they are not feminists because they're not going to marches, or, you know, that they feel like because they're not as politically active as they think they should be, they therefore can't call themselves feminists.
That's so interesting. I'm wondering if one of the things that I've noticed, especially about college students and younger, is that they're apprehensive to use the word feminist because I think because they're even far beyond labeling themselves as feminist, because it's almost like second nature for them to, especially, you know, educated kids these days, I'm the worst, but kids in college and younger, I mean, they're seeing the world and they have access to information far more readily than we ever did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've noticed some men, I was doing an interview with for a different podcast with a man, and he asked me if it was okay, how I felt about men referring to themselves as feminists. I'm like, that's great. He's like, well, we don't like that here because we feel it's men showing off. And I'm like, oh my gosh, no, I think it's great. Like, people getting caught up with the labels, the definitions, what counts, what doesn't.
Yeah. Just feminism is for everybody.
Absolutely. Actually, that's a great book by bell hooks, right?
Uh-huh, exactly.
I love that book, and I recommend that to everyone.
Well, speaking of books, today we are talking about your latest memoir, Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. Can you give us just a brief description so everybody's on the same page?
Sure. So in 2003, when I was 19 years old, my best friend of 5 years raped me when I was very drunk at a party. And the book is sort of an exploration of why I had trouble referring to it as rape. And part of that is because of the FBI's, or part of that, I mean, at the time I wasn't thinking about what's the FBI's definition of rape, but my perception of rape had so much to do with what part of, like, what was used, you know, that because this friend used his fingers that it couldn't possibly count as that and as serious. And so the book is exploring that event and reflecting on it and why I dismissed it for so long. But it also becomes a reflection on female friendships. I interview this friend right after 14 years, and I recorded the interviews and I shared the transcripts with my female friends and discussed the conversations with them, had conversations with them about my conversations with this former friend. I refer to him as Mark in the book. And yeah, so it's just a reflection on this friendship that ended in sexual assault.
There are so many avenues, so many questions I have for you, because this book is so good and it is so timely. And I know, like, part of the very beginning you say, well, it's in the zeitgeist, of course, or, you know, your agent says that, your partner says that, and you come back with, well, no, that's not why I'm writing it, but yes, I suppose it is part of the zeitgeist. Like, so it's timely, it's different, it's so unique. So it's a memoir, but it's almost a memoir in real time, because at the beginning we meet you and you have this idea for this book. And you take it to your agent and you say, hey, I want to interview my rapist. And it's just like, mind blown. And then you grapple with whether or not you actually want to go through with it. What if he says no? Is it still a project? Then you contact him. He says yes. And then you have a conversation with him. We get the transcript. Then we get you unpacking the conversation. And then the next conversation, the transcript, you unpacking it. And so that's why I'm kind of referring to it as a memoir in progress, because we see your thought process every step of the way. So I first want to know what that process was like as a writer, because it's not you recounting memories, it's you living in the moment and writing about them in the moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting because my first book took more than 10 years to write. It had been this deathbed promise to my dad. And in interviews with people after the first book, The Glass Eye, came out, they're like, wow, it took more than 10 years to write. And everybody was including that. I'm like, yes, it did. And I started to feel kind of bad. I'm like, I know, I'm going to prove to everyone I can write a book in less than a year. And so part of it was I wanted to see if I could write a book in real time. Because part of, for me, like, not that I think we need to produce, and it's so important to do something quickly, but I felt like it would be the most honest approach to understanding my thoughts and feelings by writing in real time and not allowing myself the benefit of revision over the course of months or years. I wanted to be as honest as I could. I mean, obviously editing was involved. I did a fair amount of shaping of the manuscript, but I felt like it, by writing it in real time, I could get at my actual thoughts and feelings and not revise them to be more acceptable and to whatever that means. And so for me, like, the crux of a lot of memoirs is that the thinking is the plot. It's not so much the narrative or the events, but how we think about the narrative or events. And so I thought that this would be a way of understanding my own shame about what had happened, my own regret, my own, like, I mean, I was having nightmares about it more frequently after the last presidential election. And I think part of it, I wanted to understand, why is this coming back to me now? I mean, it seems so obvious, but what else is happening in our culture that might be influencing this?
And so you take us on this journey of you processing on the page, this revisiting of trauma. And it's so interesting to me that you say, I wanted to make it as honest as possible, because so much of the book is, what is truth? Whose truth matters? And who gets to define it? And so I'm wondering how you grappled with truth and what your relationship to the truth, to use Colbert's term, the truthiness of the book is.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so much that I wanted to revise out. I mean, the conversations with Mark, I mean, there are so many times, right, where I'm caretaking for him and, you know, I'm telling him things like, I hope this is helpful for you. I hope I don't hate you. I mean, I did not realize how much I did that. And I was embarrassed. And I thought, this is actually annoying. Like, I'm annoying myself. But I wanted the reader to also have that experience. And so for me, the truth of it was tricky because there's some stuff that I don't remember, but that Mark remembered. So immediately after it happened that night, he remembered me whispering to no one, he raped me. And I didn't remember that. And so I thought, well, why would he lie about that? And so part of it was, how much do I trust him? You know, how much do I trust my own memory? I think it was helpful to have him agree to go on record and affirm my memory, because over the years, there was so much time I spent thinking, well, maybe it didn't actually happen like that, or maybe, like, did it? I had trouble believing that it actually had happened. And so it felt uncomfortable that I was giving him some authority with the narrative and saying, did it happen like this? Maybe you have a different memory. Tell me what you remember. And that was very uncomfortable, giving up some of that power. And it wasn't something I had planned to do. It just happened. It happened naturally in conversation. It was just interesting to me how much I pushed myself out of having any power and just did it naturally. Like, it didn't feel fake. It didn't feel like a performance. And yet, obviously, that behavior is learned behavior, right? Shaped by years and years of exposure to sexism.
You're just talking about wanting Mark's affirmation, wanting him to confirm what happened, and taking care of him. I think it's so interesting how you point out in the transcript, this is where I was taking care of him again, and his desires and needs. And you also bring up this idea, or this thought comes up, that does this make me a bad feminist to tell him, I don't hate you, or, you know, I don't think you're a bad person. What would you say about being a bad feminist? And is that, are you, and is that okay?
I mean, absolutely. I think at the time, I mean, some people have asked me, like, why were you so obsessed with thinking that what you were doing was wrong? Like, why did you think feminists would be angry at you? And I think part of it was when I had started writing the book in January of 2018, the dominant narrative that I was seeing is, we don't want to hear from men right now. We definitely don't want to hear from perpetrators. And it seemed that when perpetrators did speak, that they were chastised for not, and often rightly so, giving a sufficient apology. And so by even reaching out to Mark and giving him a voice, I just felt like what I was doing went against what I was hearing was acceptable. And so that's, I don't know, that's why I felt like it, what I was doing was terrible, and that I would disappoint feminists I admire. And I was very embarrassed about even telling people what the book was about. And I did get some pushback, certainly, if there were some people I had mentioned the book to, and they had told me, like, that's terrible, we don't need to hear from men. And so it just made me feel even worse. What I would often say in response is that so often, right, when we hear a sexual assault survivor describe what happened to them, a natural reaction for some people is just to think about what they would have done differently to prevent or stop the assault. And so by talking to him, I wanted to put the focus on his actions so that any readers would, you know, maybe wouldn't examine what I did as wrong, but then would just acknowledge, yes, what he did is wrong. And now let's see how this discussion plays out. And so that was how I explained my intentions. But there was one, someone I really admire as a writer, and initially she had declined to blurb the book. It was a little bit early on based on the premise, and I understood, and someone has the right, but that also I was very scared. And I understand why some people would be opposed to reading this book based on its premise, but my hope is that they would read it first and then, you know, have a decision.
Because it does complicate that societal narrative of rape being a stranger in a back alley.
Absolutely.
Somebody that you know and love and trust, and it can be really, really complicated.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because so often that's why we don't hold perpetrators accountable, is we have these complicated feelings about them, and it's hard to imagine them. I mean, part of it is we care about them, so it's hard to imagine letting the legal system hold them accountable. And part of it is the legal system often does an insufficient job, right? There's no formalized system in place, very rarely, where there's an attempt at rehabilitating the perpetrator, right? It's just, we're going to lock the perpetrators up, not hear from them for a while, and then they will be released possibly. And so I wanted to write the book because I was hearing from so many of my students who are writing about sexual assault. Often what they were saying are the same things I would hear. I remember myself thinking at that time, like, well, he was otherwise such a nice guy, and it was just like one night, and he'd been drinking and I've been drinking. And so I just thought it was important to be honest and show myself thinking through my uncomfortable feelings about this friendship that ended in rape.
And it did end at that time.
Absolutely. Yeah, it did end. I mean, certainly we tried hanging out after that in group settings, but it was never the same, and it just felt wrong.
What does accountability then look like in this situation? I know that you mentioned that in Ohio, the statute of limitations is, you haven't passed that yet. You could press charges if you wanted to, but you don't. Tell me about that thought process.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, it's complicated because there's the part of me that thinks, oh, would he do this to someone else? Like, then, you know, like, and this is something a lot of sexual assault survivors do, is they suddenly feel bad for not holding them accountable because they think, oh, if he does it again, it'll be my fault. Like, they take the blame. And so there was some thinking, I had some of those thoughts, certainly, but for me, I couldn't imagine how pressing charges would make me feel any better. In some ways, this writing the book was my way of holding him accountable, getting him to affirm what happened that night and answer any questions that I had. So the book was, I think accountability differs by situation. Like, I'm not advocating for sexual assault victims that they should reach out to the perpetrator. You know, I think it's up to the individual to decide what accountability would look like for them.
Yeah.
Or pursuing accountability, what that would look like.
Throughout the book, you press him to share with you 5 good memories of the two of you together because you were very important to each other. Why was that important to you, that he proved to you that your relationship was important to him too?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to believe that the friendship had mattered, that I wasn't being nostalgic for something that never existed. I wanted to believe that he had seen me as a full human being, as a friend, and not someone he just had a crush on and took advantage of one night. I wanted to believe that had mattered to him in the way that he had mattered to me. And it definitely made me nervous when he couldn't come up with 5 good memories for a while. And because my friend Jung had said, she's like, well, what does that say about your friendship then? And it made me reevaluate, like, had we ever really been friends? Had he ever seen me as a full human being?
This isn't the only experience of sexual violence that you've experienced or that you mentioned in the book. And I know that was from reading the book. This is what's so brilliant about it, is you take us through the thought process of every decision, and it's so good. But I know that you struggled with including those other instances. Tell us why, and do you think that ultimately was the right decision for the book?
I think it was the right decision. I had recently gotten this letter from a prisoner who actually mentioned it. It was a very long letter. He had mentioned, he said, the fact that you could recount 5 instances in your book makes me wonder if anyone I know hasn't been assaulted or harassed. It makes me wonder how many of my male friends have assaulted or raped someone. To call it disquieting is a massive understatement, but it is, and there should be more conversation about it. And that was, I mean, I think a lot of people have expressed surprise. It's strange to me, like, regardless of gender identity. I had someone interviewed me, a woman, and she had, the question wasn't maybe framed in the most sensitive way. It was, why do you think you were sexually assaulted as much as you were?
Oh my God.
And it was putting the blame back on me. And so that's partly why I wanted to include all of those instances, because it does happen. So many women I know, it has happened to them repeatedly. It's not one instance. And yeah, so I just thought it was that was an honest, representation of what had happened to me. I mean, certainly there was an impulse when I was in graduate school, and I include this in the book, but I had written about having, you know, a high school teacher who, touched me between my legs and harassed me and was verbally abusive. And I had another teacher who had read to me this like really erotic poem he had written, and I was alone in the room. He had closed the door, and you know, my workshop classmates had said, you know, one bad teacher is believable, but 2 is distracting. And I understood their point on a craft level. And this was in regards to like my first book, I was going to include them. And I got to thinking when writing my first book and how I didn't include all these instances of sexual assault. I was like, yeah, sexual assault is distracting. It was making the narrative unwieldy, the story that I was trying to tell in my first book, which is about my grief for my dad. And I think have that really carried over into when I was working on this book, some of the stuff I had deleted from that first book. I was like, it was stuff I still wanted to write about. I just didn't know. I thought, how do I write about it? And I thought, well, I devote a whole book to it.
Yeah. You teach writing and in memoir writing especially, and you talk about some of your students, and you've already mentioned that your students will write about their sexual assault situations. And I imagine that having a book like this out in the world and something as vulnerable as your first book as well opens you up to holding a lot of stories and a lot of other people's trauma. How do you navigate that?
It's really hard. I was actually just telling my partner, Chris, I was like, I'm so tired, like just tired all the time. Just having trouble thinking lately. And I think it's the end of the semester. I've been reading so many, I taught two memoir classes this fall, a graduate and an undergraduate class. But then I have students at my university who've read, I mean, I never assign my work, but they've read my work, and students who aren't my students will come to my office and say, like, I want to talk with you about what happened to me. And yeah, I mean, it's hard. I remember when the Kavanaugh hearings were happening, I had a line of students, young women outside my door, and I have a male colleague who's very progressive and cares about feminist issues, but he had no one waiting to see him, and he was playing his guitar. Like, I could hear him playing his guitar. And meanwhile, I just have this line of young women wanting, like, crying and wanting to talk to me about, like, what do? We feel so helpless. Why is this happening? And it's exhausting because there's all this other work that I want to accomplish at my university. But at the end of the day, I'm just tired. It's hard to process all of it. And sometimes my students will laugh because I will sound like a therapist in class or in meetings where I'm like, can you say more about that? Or, you know, how did that make you feel? And there's no way around, or I haven't yet discovered a way around it, because for me, so much of writing memoir is making yourself vulnerable, right? And it's hard because a lot of my students, when they're writing about trauma, it's very fresh for them, you know, and they're young, and how, like, I try to bring in a professional, like I will refer them to student counseling usually, or some of my students are in therapy, but it's hard. I haven't found a good way to really manage it. A grad student did ask me recently, she's like, how do you do it? And I was like, what? She's like, I hear the students, like when I'm waiting to meet with you, I'll hear students in your office just telling you really intimate details about their lives. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I haven't yet figured out a way, I don't think, to manage all of it.
And I will always and forever get on a soapbox to critique academia. That's unpaid emotional labor that you are doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff I don't include in my annual review report.
Right,
holding
space for trauma doesn't take up a line on a CV.
Right.
I guess it's considered service, but not the kind of service that, quote unquote, counts in academia. Yeah, that frustrates me. But on the other hand, I know I was so grateful for those professors and instructors that made room for me to be a whole person. And so, you know, looking back, maybe I could have and should have realized that they also had things they were dealing with.
Oh no, I think back now too, because I'll hear from students I had like 5 years ago, and they want me to read whatever they're working on. It's not that I'm not interested, but I just don't have, like, if I were to read every past student's work, I couldn't do it. And I feel, but I remember being a student, like right after graduation, still writing professors, and like, would you mind taking a look at this? I just wasn't even thinking about how, no, they don't want to. They have their own work to do, you know, and this is just extra for them.
Well, I don't want to let that comment about the letter from a prisoner go unnoticed. I know you and I chatted briefly before we started recording about this, and I think our listeners probably were like, wait, what the fuck? Go back to that. So I know that you've gotten quite a bit of mail from unexpected readers. So can you talk a little bit more about those responses, especially from men?
Yeah. So I had scrubbed my online presence of contact information. I mean, if someone wants to reach me, they can email my agent or my publicist. but because before, shortly before the book came out, I did get some hate mail and it was really mean. And it was from, I remember a woman had written to me, someone from Texas, who told me she didn't need to read my book to know that it was terrible and that what I was doing was harming rape survivors and that I was a terrible person. And she's like, I hope you make a lot of money from this book. And I was like, well, she clearly doesn't understand how independent publishing works. Because if I was trying to make money from this book, I don't think I would have written like it in the form that I did, like this meta narrative, and then sold it to an independent publisher based in Portland, Oregon. Like, I was not trying to make money from this book, but I felt so bad after getting that. So I just had removed my contact information. So people, actually mostly prisoners, are sending me letters to my work. So I don't know what the secretary is thinking, because like outside of every envelope, usually there's a stamp that's like mailed from a correctional institution. So getting a lot of those. And yeah, I had gotten one earlier this week from an inmate in Florida who had said he read my book and he's now passing it along to other men in his prison dormitory. He said, in the hopes that others will be compelled as I was to reflect on their actions. I felt kind of naive for thinking, oh, of course, remorseful. And this prisoner wrote to me, he went to graduate school. He's in prison because of, he had sex with one of his students, a 15-year-old high school student. And, but he writes about other experiences and how he used his power in graduate school to let some of his students, he would tell, he very much implied, he said at some point in this letter, that if they dated him or had sex with him, he made it pretty clear that it would work to their benefit. And he hadn't thought of it at the time as bad. And so it's been kind of hard getting these letters where I don't like the, I don't know, like some of my friends are, you know, I'll tell them about it and they'll be a little bit more cynical, and maybe rightly so, than I am. They're like, well, why do you think they're doing it? They can't get forgiveness from the people they harm, so now they're unloading this on you. And but I'm still appreciative for these letters, because I'm glad that I know the book is reaching men as well as women. Because the thing that's happened in a lot of events, or you know, when I'm being introduced to an audience, they'll mention like, this is a book that all women and girls need to read. And I'm like, no, like everybody, it's not just for young, for girls and women. You know, I think so often sexual assault gets framed as a women's issue and not a feminist issue. And so these letters from male prisoners, I'm, you know, I appreciate, they're hard to read, but I appreciate them.
And something I bet you never saw coming.
No, I wasn't. I was not expecting it. When I got the first one, I thought, oh, okay, like this is nice. And then I've been getting more and more. And like, okay, I don't know. Maybe they can stop. this is getting a little bit to be too much. But yeah, but you know, as a writer, you want your book to reach people. And I'm sad that I took my contact information down, because one of the best parts about releasing the first book was hearing from readers and people telling me how much the book helped them. And, you know, so now I'm not really hearing from people as much, just because it's hard to reach me unless you write me a letter to my work address.
But it also speaks to, gosh, when you are speaking out on feminist issues, it can be really dangerous and it puts you up for a lot of scrutiny. And so as someone who has a folder named microaggressions on my own phone, I understand that it piles up pretty quickly.
Yeah, I just didn't think I could take it. I mean, maybe at some point I'll put my contact information, my personal email, back on my website. Cause I mean, I'm not on social media, and partly it's to protect myself from a lot of that. It's hard as a writer. Certainly I don't think I could write the sort of work that I write if I was hyper aware of readers. I tend not to think about readers too much while I'm writing, cause otherwise it's hard for me to make myself vulnerable in the way that I know I need to make myself vulnerable for memoir. And it's just, so it's not like I'm against social media or writers who are on social media. Like, I know why it can be useful or rewarding, but for me, I get already, I'm doing a lot of emotional labor at my work. So
yeah. You need a little pass on that, but you are touring quite a bit. And I was so lucky to see you here in Minneapolis recently. So thank you for stopping by here. Where else can listeners find you in the new year?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm going to the Virginia Book Festival and then the LA Times Book Festival and a few other spots. I haven't lined up too much. I think this fall I got really burned out from a lot of touring. But the LA Times Book Festival and the Virginia Festival of the Book, those immediately come to mind. And then I'm just doing I'm going to like Fort Meade and some smaller venues to talk to audiences, but maybe I've got that on my website. So I do update that with my tour schedule. So if people are interested in coming to an event, they can check that out.
Yep. And that's jeanievanasco.com. Super easy.
Yes.
So as we wrap up, the last question we ask everyone is, if you have a book to recommend that's not your own that our listeners should check out, what would that be?
Well, you had her as a guest, Sophia Shalmiev.
So good.
Her book, Mother Winter, is so good. I love that book. I was lucky enough, I did an event with her, Politics and Prose, earlier in the year. And she's just brilliant. I mean, hyper brilliant. And I have assigned her book, and it's one of the few that my students just universally love, and it's permanently parked on my creative nonfiction and memoir syllabi.
Absolutely. Such a great one. I will leave a link to that in the show notes, as well as a link to our interview with Sophia, because she was a great guest. She's just a joy, and that book is so good. So I'm glad you suggested that one. Jeanie, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Absolutely wonderful. I'm so glad our paths have crossed in so many interesting and weird ways. And I can't wait to see what's next from you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.